We are in Genesis chapter number 15. The year, I believe, that we're talking about here is 2091 BC, 10 years after Abram had arrived in Canaan from Ur of the Chaldees. We know that because of the story that's coming up very, very soon. And Abram has just rescued his nephew Lot from the united Mesopotamian army that had come down to bring the cities of the plain in southern Dead Sea Valley back under their boot. And Abram had not just simply rescued his own nephew, he'd rescued all of those that had been captured in this military operation, plus all the stuff. And he came back, and we talked about a worship service that took place at Salem, or Jerusalem. The next thing we read is this: after these things, the word of He who is came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. And I suggested to you last session that the first part of that statement from the Lord was to calm any fears down that Abram might have when he realized, oh my goodness, I took on an army out of Mesopotamia and defeated them. What if there's reprisals? Well, God's response is basically, don't worry about reprisals. I'm your shield. And then the second part might refer to the fact that he had refused to take any of the booty, any of the reward money, if you will, offered to him by the king of Sodom, probably representing the five kings of the Valley of Siddim, the Valley of Fields, the very wealthy five cities there, more than likely where the South Bay of the Dead Sea used to be. And since he didn't take any of that, God's response is, don't worry about that. You passed on that, but I am guaranteeing you, you will still receive a great reward from me. Verse 2, but Abram said, oh, he who is my God. Remember that we've got the divine name that keeps being inserted in the text here by Moses, who is the author of the book of Genesis. The divine name was not yet revealed in the time of Abram, but Moses feels the need, the prompting of the Holy Spirit, to keep his readers, his first readers, the Israeli people coming out of Egypt, connected to the reality that the God of Abram is the God with the name He Who Is that's taking the Israelis out of Egypt to the Promised Land. So more than likely, Abram knows God by the name God Most High. We saw that in the story of Melchizedek. Or El Shaddai, which in the book of Genesis more than likely represents my God, the God of my chest. So Abram says to God, my God, what will you give me? Meaning my reward. How are you going to reward me when I continue childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? So that's kind of where we broke off last session, is that Abram's response is basically, what good does it do me to be given lots of stuff when I don't have anyone of my own body, my own heir, to pass it on to? And at this point, he says, the heir of my things is going to be someone named Eleazar of Damascus. Now, I'm going to throw something in here that you're not going to hear anywhere else. This is unique to me. At least I've never seen it with anyone else. When I look in the Hebrew text at this point, and I look in the Greek text as well at this point, I see that the literal structure of this name is not Eleazar of Damascus. It's actually Damascus Eleazar. Now, that may not sound like anything big to you, but it does feel weird in the text. It doesn't have a possessiveness in the structure of the text to Eleazar belonging to the city of Damascus. Instead, I started exploring other possibilities as to why this structure would be here, and I discovered that the name Damascus actually is made up of two words. One is Dam, which means blood, and the other is Sak, which, interestingly enough, means sack. And so it sounds like maybe it's ultimately the source word for our name, Sak. And it is used in other places as a reference to what's called an in-call birth. And what it means is the baby is born inside the placenta, inside the amniotic sac, I guess I should say better, that the whole thing comes out. Sometimes it pops on the way out, and it just only gets on top of the head. And these are very rare, but when they happened in the ancient world, it was looked at as something special. It was considered a good omen that this baby was going to be a special person. And it seems as if the better translation here is, he is saying, Abram is saying, at this moment, my heir is Bloodsack Eleazar. Which is probably a reference to a baby boy that was born in the tent city of Abram, the first baby born in that tent city after Abram became the patriarch of his clan, meaning right after his father died, which means on the way from Haran, where his father died, into Canaan, where we've been reading about his story. And interestingly enough, Damascus is on the road to Canaan from Haran. And so I would give a double suggestion that the baby boy was born and Abram names his tent city, his encampment, after that baby boy because of the unusual birth, blood sack. Eleazar. Eleazar, by the way, means God is my help or God helps me. And that name of the encampment attaches itself permanently to the site and therefore becomes the name for Damascus itself. So rather than Eleazar being named after Damascus, I suggest Damascus is named after Eleazar. And Josephus, the first century Jewish writer, references a story amongst the Damascene people. In fact, he references a historian from that city that Abram arrived in that region with a whole lot of people, and he was a powerful ruler there for a while, as he was coming out of Aram, that is, out of the area where Haran is. So, throw it all together, and this is what I'm suggesting to you. Abram is saying, I have basically adopted a special boy born in my own household after I became the patriarch, as the one that I will give everything to when I'm dead because I don't have a kid. And God's response is this. Now, first, I need to finish up what Abram said, verse 3 of Genesis 15. Abram said, "Behold, you have given me no offspring." Whoa, this comes off a little bit strong, doesn't it? But he's just having a frank conversation with God. "You haven't given me a child of my body. And so a member of my household will be my heir." And then comes God's response. "Behold, the word of he who is came to him. This man," and by the way, man is not in the literal text of Hebrew or Greek. It's just the preposition this, or this one. "This one shall not be your heir." That is, Eliezer is not going to be your heir. "Your very own son," the literal wording is the one that comes from your own loins, so your body son, "shall be your heir." So your own flesh and blood son is going to be your heir, I promise you. Verse 5, "God then brought him outside and said," so it's nighttime, "look toward heaven, number the stars as if you are able to number them." So imagine this is back at a time when there was no real artificial lighting at night. The closest thing you get would be a bonfire. And so the sky is just brilliant with stars at night. The Milky Way is extremely obvious when you go out there. And so God says, "Direct your eyes heavenward, Abram. You want to try to count those stars up there?" And of course, you're overwhelmed when you see that. Of course you don't. It's just an innumerable number of stars. And so that's the point. If you are able to number the stars, then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be," or your seed. Now, the word seed is a collective singular. It is singular in form, but it can at times take on a plural designation. And this is one of those places. It is obvious, since numbers are being mentioned, that God is telling Abram, you are going to have more offspring, more children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, more descendants than you could even imagine counting. And we're not just talking about all of his physical genetic offspring, because by the time we get to the New Testament, we are reminded that anyone that adopts the faith of Abraham in the Messiah, who is the ultimate seed of Abraham, Paul makes a big deal out of that in Galatians chapter 3, that we, Gentiles, we become the offspring of Abram as well. So all of those who are Gentile Christians are also part of this innumerable host of offspring. And what does Abram do after this revelation from God? Verse 6, very famous. He believed he who is, or he trusted him, or he had faith in him. And he, meaning God, counted it to him as righteousness. And you see this quoted in Romans chapter 4 and Galatians chapter 3 and James chapter 2, that Abram or Abraham trusted God and this was accounted to him or reckoned to him as righteousness, and that this becomes the model, the pattern for all of us. If we just trust God and act in faith, that proves, that adheres to the idea that we are part of the righteous that follow him. So a very good verse here to keep in mind. Verse 7, we're not done yet. He said to him, I am he who is, who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees. So again, God doesn't use that name, Yahweh, here. He probably uses either El Elyon, God Most High, or El Shaddai, God of your chest, or your God. I'm the God who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to possess, meaning the land of Canaan. So that was the whole point. Abram's faith was exercised in leaving the place where he grew up and where his family was to come to a place he did not know, didn't have any connections in, and God was going to give it to him and his descendants, his seed. Verse 8, but he said, oh, Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it? Very similar in form, the wording here, to when he said, how do I know you're going to give me a son? Things like that. He said to him, bring me a heifer, a young female cow, 3 years old, which is an interesting number because in other places, it's a three-year-old animal that is offered as the sacrifice at the time of weaning. Weaning is not so much a technical time when a child is off of milk and on solid food, but rather when they transition from being a baby to being a young girl or boy ready to be trained. And so that seems to always happen right around the third birthday. And so when the weaning ceremony happens, it's a three-year animal that is sacrificed for the party. So here, it's 3 years animal that are sacrificed for this. And we've just been talking about an heir. So I think that there might be some tie-in to that. He said to him, bring me a heifer, 3 years old, a female goat, 3 years old, a ram, 3 years old, a turtle dove of indeterminate age, apparently, and a young pigeon. Now, some commentators have pointed out, and I think rightfully so, that you see an example here of the five key sacrificial animals. Cows or bulls, goats, sheep, doves, pigeons. And so all five are offered in this sacrifice ceremony. What kind of ceremony is it? It is what's called a cutting of a covenant. And the cutting is literal. Verse 10, he brought him all these, cut them in half, and laid them half over against the other. But he didn't cut the birds in half. So basically, he takes the heifer, sacrifices her, cuts her throat, cuts her in half, puts one half one side, other half other side. Does the same thing with the goat, the same thing with the ram. Since he has two birds, he cuts their throats, but he puts them opposite from one another. Now, what's he just done? He has made a bloody path that he is going to be expected to walk through. This is a ceremony that had already been established in the ancient world. When two or more parties wanted to enter into a very serious agreement, they would do something like this, and then together they would walk the bloody path between the sacrifices, making promises that if I do not keep my side of the bargain, may I die. May my blood be spilled like these animals. So this is the cutting of a covenant ceremony that we hear about. Now, God has had him set up the ceremony, but the ceremony has not yet happened. Verse 11, when the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, which you would expect, Abram drove them away. So he's like, get out of here. Get, you know, chasing the crows, the ravens, the turkey vultures, whatever it was, the eagles of that area, the golden eagles. So he chases them away. You know, don't eat these. This is something special that needs to be happening here. Until finally, the ceremony actually takes place. Verse 12. As the sun was going down, so it's sunset, a deep sleep fell on Abram. Now, the last time we saw something like that was right before God took genetic material out of Adam and made Eve. So something similar. God puts Abram to sleep. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. So he's sedated, maybe not fully out of it, because he apparently witnesses some things here. Then he who is said to Abram, know for certain, and I love the Hebrew here, it's knowing you shall know. And it's represented perfectly in the Greek as well, in exactly those same terms. This is that idiom that we've seen before, dying you shall die. It's a way of expressing certitude. So you can know for certain that your seed will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted in this way for 400 years. Now, remember, the first people reading the book of Genesis, the intended initial audience, are the Israelites coming out of Egypt under Moses, heading for the Promised Land. And guess what? They had been there since Jacob, their ancestor, had moved them all there in the time of Joseph, 430 years. So just over the 400-year mark that we see here. And while they were there, they ended up becoming servants, slaves, exactly as predicted here. And so what we're seeing here is God in the book of Genesis explaining again to the Israeli people, I already knew this was all going to happen before it happened. And I told your ancestor Abram it was going to happen. Verse number 14, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, that would be the Egyptians, that would be the plagues, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions, which happened as well on their way out, according to instructions given by God to Moses, to the Israeli people. They were to ask all of their Egyptian neighbors that they'd been slaving for to give them their back wages. And thus they plundered the Egyptians. And so all of the Israelis came out of Egypt with the back wages for their 430 years there, and some of that being as slaves, exactly according to this prophecy. Verse 15, as for yourself, meaning you, Abram, you shall go to your fathers in peace, meaning you shall die in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, which he will, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, meaning your descendants that we're talking about here will come back to the promised land area in the fourth generation. And the fourth generation at this time is being calculated in 100-year components, which probably is tied into the idea of the flood and post-flood period that many of these people didn't even get married until they were approaching or near their 100th birthday. So they're going to come back here after 400 years. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So the Amorites are the Canaanites living in the land, and God tells Abraham, I'm not done giving the Amorites time to get their act together. But 400 years after the Israelites have been in Egypt, they'll be done. They will be ready for judgment. And they were. And the Israelites have already been told that. Let's finish it up. Verse 17. When the sun had gone down, so sun is all the way down now, and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. This is a physical manifestation representing God. Remember how I told you that both parties would walk the path, the bloody path? In this case, God won't let Abram walk. He walks alone because God alone is making this promise, this covenant. On that day, he who is made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your seed, singular meaning Jesus, collective singular meaning the Israeli people, to your seed I give this land from the river of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Eresh, to the great river, the river Euphrates, that's the bend where the Balik River is, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, which are the giants, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites. All these different ites are basically the Canaanites who, because of their sin, are being dispossessed by the Israelis. And the Israelis reading this know that God had promised this to their father, Abraham, many years earlier.